This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the UW Varsity Band is bringing back its spring concert after missing 2 years because of the pandemic. We'll talk to the band director about what it means to be back in front of a live audience. Now on Monday, a federal judge in Florida overturned the federal mask mandate for public transportation, which the Biden administration had just extended to May 3rd. The Justice Department said it will appeal the decision if the CDC says the mandate is still necessary. But in the meantime, the TSA has stopped enforcing the mandate, and all major airlines in the U.S. have made masks optional. We're talking about the end of the federal transportation mask mandate, which extends to all mass transportation, including buses and trains. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you ready to stop wearing your mask on the bus or in airports or not? Do you feel safe going mask-free anywhere? What advice do you need on when to wear a mask or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Dan Shirley is an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Shirley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We know that COVID numbers have been down for the most part lately, nudging back up in terms of cases, deaths down under 500 per day for the first time. What do you think about the timing of ending this mandate and the impact it could have on the spread of the disease?
Like you mentioned, it's super positive that we're noticing less hospitalizations and less deaths from COVID. But we have noticed an increase in cases in the community. And even that is complicated because fewer people are getting kind of the reportable PCR testing and doing more home testing, which is a good thing in its own right. But I think we, in the setting of rising cases, we worry a little bit about decreasing some of the layers of protection that might lead to increased cases.
There are a couple different elements here. First of all, people might be wondering, am I personally safe if I wear a mask and everybody around me is unmasked, or I guess vice versa? From a personal health angle, I imagine as an infectious disease doctor, people ask you all the time, hey, when should I wear a mask? What is your current advice for people going on a bus, a plane, whatever?
The advice is about the same as it's been in that, you know, there are a lot of different things to consider about whether you should mask. Your personal health, your risk for getting severe disease, that has to do with your immune system and whether you have other medical conditions. But really also what sort of situation are you going into? Is it going to be crowded? Are there people there that are going to be masked or not masked? You don't know people's vaccine status. Really just the uncertainty of where you're going and how close together and how indoors people are going to be. In those situations still would be the recommended time to wear a mask. Obviously that has become more complicated if we're talking about some of those places now not mandating masks. So now you are going into more situations with groups of people who are likely to be less masked overall. Your personal thought about a mask, now it's more important to wear a good mask more than ever.
That's from the individual health perspective. Now, on a public health angle, and people have said, I think since the beginning of COVID, part of why we want people to wear masks early on was not just to keep you from getting sick, but to slow the spread of the disease to protect others, maybe others now who might be more vulnerable. What do you think about masking right now from a public health perspective?
Yeah, I think that part has gotten a little lost in the shuffle. And that's really how I think about it. This whole pandemic has transitioned a little bit into how do we protect the vulnerable? And one way you can do that is to wear a mask, not because you feel sick or you're worried about your own risk for COVID, but to protect other people. And really, that is a good way to think about going into public and these other situations that we're talking about, buses, trains, and planes. It's super important to consider that angle.
And these are vehicles that go from one place to another, bringing in people who are going from different places to different places. Is this a particular point of concern? You know, what we do when we're going from one place to another, is this a particular place of concern for the spread of disease?
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone, almost everyone has encountered take a trip and then you come back and you get a cold. And that's kind of what we're talking about here is these modes of transit or just travel in general are how respiratory viruses are spread. We've known that pre-COVID. Everyone has experienced that. planes are, themselves have great ventilation while they're in the air. But, you know, while you're waiting for everybody to get on the plane, the ventilation's not great. Getting through the airport, traveling through the airport, standing in lines, those are the riskier times. Buses and subways, trains, those are much less ventilated overall. And those are really the concern when we're talking about removing mask mandates.
Talking to Dr. Dan Shirley from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, infectious disease expert there, looking at the end, at least for now, after a court ruling of the federal mandate requiring people to wear masks on planes and buses and trains, anywhere where you're traveling with a bunch of people on the same vehicle. You could join in with your reactions to that ruling, your personal behavior. What are you going to do? Is it going to change now? Are you going to keep on wearing a mask or no? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Our reporter Rob Mentzer asked people in Wausau how they feel about their city there no longer requiring masks on public transit. Here is one person who favored keeping going with masks.
I think it made a lot of sense to keep the mask mandate for public transportation because although our buses aren't very crowded, oftentimes airports, airplanes, buses, trains are quite crowded. So when people are stuck in close proximity, the risk of infection goes up. So it made sense to me.
Dr. Shirley, again, that's something we've heard from the beginning. A high point for transmission can be lots of people crowded in a limited amount of space.
Yes, it really is one of the major factors in spreading any infectious disease is, you know, how close together and how prolonged is that contact with other people. This disease is particularly tricky because we know it can spread if you're asymptomatic or even pre-symptomatic. So you don't know that you're about to have symptoms, but you could still spread this disease. That's why this is trickier than usual.
And then Rob also talked to someone who was happy the mandate was lifting. The person said they were unable to wear a mask because they'd had brain surgery that affected his nasal passageways. Here's a listen.
I have medical issues. And one thing that's been frustrating for me with the hospitals, the buses, the CDC clearly stated that if you have medical conditions, you're by ADA law, American with Disabilities Act law, you're exempt from the mask mandate. But go ahead and try to argue that with anybody.
Dr. Shirley, I think it's rare, but not non-existent, people with conditions that make it very difficult at best for them to wear masks.
Yeah, I think that is definitely a consideration. But like you mentioned, it's certainly not the majority, but definitely needs to be considered in these things. Another kind of example is that of that is a very small children that can't wear masks and also can't be vaccinated. So, you know, that's a tricky topic in its own right.
Is part of the story how we reach out to people and how we communicate with each other, Dr. Shirley? Maybe this is a little outside of your area, but we've had people hostilely trying to enforce mask mandates and people, you know, mocking and criticizing people who do wear masks in places. I don't know. What would you hope to see in how we interact with each other on an issue like this that really shouldn't maybe be that controversial?
Absolutely. I think it is really just a major issue. And I think that neither way is good. These kind of reactionary tones, both directions. I think it really is best to think about this as a community effort. We're talking about public health. You obviously should consider your own health, but it is super important for us to work as a group and a team to kind of decrease this spread of COVID. And really thinking about the fact that I am protecting other people.
Let's go to a caller now. Peter is with us in Rochester, Minnesota. Peter, hi.
Hey, yeah. So I am actually a research sales associate for a company, and I travel from state to state in the Midwest and kind of outside the Midwest. And I just think it's pretty ridiculous that they're getting rid of the mandate so early. You know, being that we have kind of this dwindling thing of COVID going on, you know, there are a myriad of reasons why you guys have already talked about it's important to wear a mask and, you know, with everybody traveling and travel increasing, like this just seems like the wrong time to be doing that.
Peter, do you fly a lot for your work in particular, or do you take other forms of non-car transportation?
Yeah, I mean, I drive and I visit people at customer sites, but I also do fly as well. So it just depends on the distance.
And do you plan on your next flight? Are you still going to keep a mask on?
Oh, I'm wearing a mask, I'm wearing gloves, I'm wearing a face shield, I'm wearing two masks, actually. Like, there is no reason why everybody shouldn't still be wearing masks. I believe. But you know, that's my opinion, even though it is a public health thing.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Peter, all in on the mask wearing. Dr. Shirley, is there, Peter's saying he's not ready to go without masks yet. Is there, Dr. Shirley, a point where you would say, okay, now, even in a tightly enclosed space like this, this is when we could say we can feel safe going mask-free?
Yeah, I think an important point here is that, you know, we've gone through different waves and surges, and there have been different mandates on masking, and we've pulled those back. And all indoors, for instance, in lots of locations has been removed. I think this is a stepwise thing based on the rates of COVID in the community. And I think the issue is just the timing. I think everyone's working towards knowing, you know, the rates are low and we can back off some of these things. Mask mandates as a whole for a whole community is tricky. But when we're talking about, you know, consistently risky, confined areas like a bus, I think that's why it's just different, is that that can be mandated and actually adhered to. And we know that's a risky situation compared to, say, a mandate for something that's less risky, where people are spread out and wearing, able to spread out mostly, and the airflow is good.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We're talking about the recent court ruling overturning a federal mask mandate requiring masks on planes, buses, and other mass transit, plus airports. Dr. Dan Shirley stays with us, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. Are you, or maybe someone in your family, immunocompromised in some way, where you feel an extra risk of being in a place where people aren't masked, being on a plane or a bus, for example, where people aren't masked? What are your feelings on the overturning of the public transit mask mandate? Do you have kids under 5 who can't be vaccinated yet? How do you feel about this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Dan Shirley about masks on public transportation, planes, buses, and more. A court ruling said the federal mandate ends. Dan's an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want that mandate to stay in place? Are you glad to see it gone? With or without it, do you plan to continue wearing masks if and when you go on a vehicle, flying or ground-based with other humans? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Shirley, I know people are watching for the numbers and things like that, trying to weigh, make their own decisions about health precautions. You mentioned those at-home tests. And I've heard suggestions, and you were hinting at this earlier, that maybe that's making it harder to track trends because, you know, if I take a test, it's negative, it's positive. I don't necessarily call up the city or the county or whatever and tell them about it. Is that making it harder to track the spread of COVID and the latest numbers?
Well, I do think it makes the numbers look a little bit lower, but I think the trajectory, meaning the cases seem to be going up, that seems to be true, whether we're testing fewer people or not. The other thing is we have other ways to kind of measure this. And it, for the healthcare setting, we test people before procedures who don't have symptoms, for instance. And obviously we have testing readily available for our healthcare workers. So we know kind of what the rates are related to those. And those all kind of track with what we see in the community as far as the reported numbers right now.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Two Rivers. John, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm retired, and I flew 100 flights a year for 30 years. End of June, me and my daughter's family with 2 grandchildren, we're going to fly to Florida to see her in-laws. And we've canceled the flights and decided to drive. We just can't take a chance with the 2 young kids. I have chronic conditions, and people aren't going to wear masks. We're not going to fly on an airplane.
John, thanks so much for sharing that story. Dr. Shirley, I think a lot of people may be rethinking travel plans. Some people were surprised when the announcement came on while they were literally on a plane that the rules had shifted on the way. Do you expect to see people reconsidering their travel plans now?
Yeah, I do. I mean, this is a, even for myself, it makes me wonder, you know, should I take this trip? I think everyone has to kind of decide how important is this. I think this relates to buses and trains even more because people must take those modes of transportation to get to their job or, you know, help out with their family, those types of things. So the stakes are even higher for those other types of transportation. Obviously, people need to ride planes to visit family and do their job too, but I just think the stakes are even higher for those modes of transit for everyday use.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at the latest trends, the latest variants, you know, the numbers are going up. They're not skyrocketing with the new variant. What are your thoughts, Dr. Shirley, on what we're watching for here?
I think we're in a pretty good position right now, which is great as far as the timing that, you know, enough people got vaccinated and boosted, and a lot of people got Omicron during that last surge, which has left us with, you know, there are infections around and the cases are rising, but that so far hasn't resulted in hospitalization. I think the danger of having kind of ongoing transmission is something we already know about, which is new variants. And that's really what we don't want to have happen. The other question is, how long does this protection from either vaccination or infection last? You know, we might be good while everybody goes out for the summer, but what's going to happen if cases are this high, people are close together as we get back into the fall?
Let's go back to our callers now. Don is with us in Madison. Don, hello.
Yeah, hi. I guess you kind of started to hit on what I was going to bring up, but basically, you know, it seems like lately that the numbers are what are talked about. Oh, the numbers are going up. It's up 10% from this point. But what isn't, at least what I've not seen and what makes it, you know, seem to me that this is becoming more of an endemic situation as opposed to pandemic, is the number of resultant deaths related to the number of infections, which people are actually being impacted by it. Like the guy that was, you know, in his mid late 70s, you know, obviously with conditions that made it serious for him. So mask wearing on a plane is prevalent to him. But, you know, for the vast majority of people that, you know, I'll go to Woodman, say, in Madison, and I'll put a mask on because there's tons of people in there, right? So I don't want to take that risk. But I realize that if I get the virus, the likelihood is I'm going to probably just have mild flu-like symptoms, and I'm not going to have, you know, that deep respiratory symptoms that was killing people, you know, a year and a half ago. So, that's what I'm saying. We're talking about the numbers, but we're not actually digging deeply into what the actual impact is to people related to the current, you know, the Omicron or whatever the latest Omicron variant is.
Gotcha. Don, thanks for the call. And those numbers are, the case numbers are going up from what is happily a fairly low level. But Dr. Shirley, what do we know about the lethality and the harm done by the current most common variant of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true that so far we haven't seen the hospitalizations and the severe disease. And really, that was the focus of the vaccine from the beginning. And luckily, that's also held true for Omicron because the new subvariant is still Omicron. So people have been relatively well protected. The danger here and why maybe our focus has shifted a little bit is that some people don't react well to the vaccine or prior infection because of their immune system. Or the stakes are just higher because of like a chronic lung condition that if they get COVID, they will be a person that has a more severe case. So yes, those people are fewer, but it is not uncommon for people to have immune problems or medical conditions. A significant proportion of our population that has that. So I agree that there is over time been some sort of evolution of how we deal with this. And there are just more knowledge about where are the riskiest spots and when should we implement all our layers of protection.
Don, thanks for the call. Jamie joins us now in Edgerton. Jamie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jamie?
I just wanted to say thank you for bringing up this conversation. And I just wanted to talk about the fact of I am personally, my family is very happy that the mask mandate for federal public transportation has been overturned. I personally feel like it should have been a personal choice the entire time. it should have never been mandated in the first place. If you feel like for yourself, it should have been, you wanted to wear a mask, that's fine. That's up to you. But to have it been mandated this entire time, I don't feel is right. If people are vaccinated, boosted, that's your choice. And the same thing with the vaccination. That is a choice. It should never be forced upon anybody.
Jamie, so thanks for the call. Thank you for calling in, Jamie. Just have a few moments left. Dr. Shirley, from the public health angle, that I think is why sometimes people are reluctant to say it's personal choice, because you're trying to stop the spread of the disease in the population. What do you think of what Jamie brought up?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of just a broad argument over time of where does public health stop and start, and when does individual freedoms or choices start? I think the issue with the public transportation is that it is public transportation. So people use it as a means to get to their job or go to the hospital or whatever. And so it's not necessarily a choice to use kind of the public facilities. And that's where, you know, that's why this is the discussion we're having right now, that this is kind of the last place where things were mandated. You know, I think it is that thought of, you know, I don't fear for myself so much as should I do something to protect the other people that might also be using that mode of transit.
Thanks for the call, Jamie. Just in our last 30 seconds, Dr. Shirley, masks do make a difference, right?
Yeah, they do. I think we know that a better mask does filter better. Having two people face each other that both have masks is better than just one or none. And, you know, there's arguments about, you know, what is the best mask for the best situation. But I think the biggest thing is something that's comfortable that you can wear, implemented in the risky situations that we're talking about.
Dr. Shirley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
No problems. Thank you.
That's Dr. Dan Shirley, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about a court ruling overturning the public transit mask mandate. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Start your weekdays with great conversations on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow, supply chain issues are making baby formula harder to buy. Find out how big the problem is, what it'll take to fix it. That's tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Friday and Saturday, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Varsity Band is holding its first spring concert since the start of the pandemic. It'll be the first concert not directed by Mike Lacrone, who retired in 2019 after 50 years leading the band. He started the first spring concert in 1975. The tradition picks up again this weekend. Corey Pompey is the Michael E. Lacrone Director of Athletic Bands and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Marching Band, conducts the concert band, and teaches classes in the Meade-Witter School of Music. I talked to him yesterday. It's been a couple years since I talked to you, a couple years since you've been on the job. Then COVID happened, and this spring concert, this big first spring concert directed the band, kept getting postponed. How big a deal is it that you get to get the band back together and have this big spring concert?
Well, it's a huge deal. This concert, up until COVID happened, had been going on for 46 years. And so to not continue that tradition was a big blow to all of us. So we're thankful that we have the opportunity again, and we're just excited to get this thing off of the ground.
Now, for those who haven't been able to make it to one of these spring concerts in the past, this isn't just the band showing up and playing. This is has been in the past a big production. Can you talk about why this is such a big show?
Well, you know, it was a big show because there were a lot of production elements that were involved in the show, and we'll certainly have production elements this time. But over the course of the 4 to 6 years, the show just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And perhaps most famously, my predecessor, Mike Lacrone, would fly in and fly above the audience and do different things like that. So there were a lot of those things that were involved with the show, and people really enjoyed those things.
I understand you will not be on Wires yourself, and I'm right there with you.
That is correct. I will not be on Wires myself.
Now, you haven't been able to do the spring show, but that doesn't mean you haven't done anything. Can you talk about the challenges of running, especially the marching band, during COVID?
Oh, my gosh. It where do you want me to start is the question. The worst of it, I shall say, was during the football season when they weren't allowing spectators in the stadium. That was pretty tough for us because we were not doing any public performances. We went an academic year without doing any public performances. That fall semester, we were only able to meet in small groups at a time. So really, until August of 2021, the full band had not been together since the shutdown. And so managing that was a real challenge. Fast forward to the football season of 2021. Well, having to deal with what happens when someone contracts COVID. How do we navigate through that? So that was a big challenge. But it pales in comparison to the year when we didn't get a chance to perform for the listening public.
Now, a marching band, I know I was in marching band in high school. It's a community in a lot of ways. Were you able to do things to keep that sense of community and togetherness for the band over those difficult couple of years?
We tried, but I will confess it was very, very difficult because we could not rehearse in large numbers. And so, you know, they didn't get to see each other as much as they're accustomed to seeing each other. And that was one of the things that we heard time and time again during that year, was the sense that there was a loss of community because we couldn't play music together. We couldn't be around each other doing the things that we loved. However, we did what we could, and we operated as best we could under the circumstances.
Now, we had fans back in the stands in the fall. Can you take us back to the first moment when your crew marched out onto the field with, you know, cheering Badger fans?
Oh, there's no way to describe what that moment was like. It was just a joyous occasion for the students in the band. You know, for a large chunk of the band, they never marched in the stadium before. They never had that crowd response. And I must say, that first game back, the crowd was just, they were with us. And we felt it, and we appreciated it very much. And I'm sure they had similar feelings to us. You know, missing out on a full season of football was not fun for those of us that enjoy going into Camp Randall and having those Saturday experiences.
Now, you were, as a band, just like a lot of us in the world, marching in place for a long time there. Do you feel like you're back on track and saying, okay, now we can figure out, you know, what kind of things we want to do, change, expand into the future with this band?
We're getting there. We're not there yet. You know, we're still in the midst of transition and different things like that. And COVID certainly has not helped. But we're well on our way. And hopefully any changes we do make will be, I'm not sure what the correct word is, but any changes won't be perceived by the average listener or the average viewer, because our goal is for the band to be the band, regardless of who's in front of it, who's leading it. We want that ensemble, when they perform, to be recognizable to everyone.
All right, getting back to the spring concert before we're done. I don't know if you want to have spoilers here. What is on the set list for the show?
Oh, okay. Well, certainly the tunes that Badger fans know and love. There'll also be a heavy dose of tunes from the fifth quarter. In addition to that, there'll be a little Panic at the Disco. There'll be a little Queen and some other tunes in there. So hopefully we'll have a variety of music that people in the audience can tap their toes to and enjoy.
Corey, have a great show, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you all for having me.
Corey Pompey is the Director of Athletic Bands and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He leads the UW Marching Band, conducts the Concert Band, and teaches classes at the Meade-Witter School of Music. He's leading the Varsity Band in the annual spring concert on Friday and Saturday night. Tickets can be purchased at badgerband.com. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about the importance of community during trying times.
Taking notice and being thankful for the family and community we have around us often occurs when we're facing our most difficult circumstances. Writer Jan Larson brings us an essay about gratitude and the lessons learned on her journey to recovery.
I am standing on the shore, arms at my sides, hands open, palms facing the sea as gentle swells touch the shore. The horizon shows no hint of the storms to come. The first wave laps at my toes. Let's order a CT scan just to be safe, my doctor suggests. A white puff appears, dim on the horizon. Are you driving? Can you pull over? I am in Friday night Minneapolis traffic, heading to an Airbnb where my adult daughter and I will spend the weekend making COVID-19 masks, watching girl movies, and visiting over a bottle of wine. And now, swallowing fear. I'm sorry, the CT scan came back abnormal. We'll schedule an MRI for Monday. The waves cover the tops of my feet. It's a tumor, the neurosurgeon I met moments before tells me. Unable to join me during the office visit, another bit of COVID-19 fallout, my husband Lauren phones in from the hospital parking lot. He listens. There is nothing to say. The images tell a story. The tumor measures roughly 3 inches long by an inch wide. It has been there a while, slowly taking up space meant for my brain. My feet melt into the wet sand as the waves cover my ankles. I breathe in and blow out, trying to calm my frantic heart. We are in Rochester with yet another neurosurgeon. He assures us the tumor is benign. We cling to hope. Clouds on the horizon show hints of gray. The seas build, and I brace myself for the waves that splash white foam up my legs. It is early morning. A young resident appears at my bedside. My head is swathed in bandages a la The Mummy. Lauren already knows what I am just learning. The tumor is malignant. A rogue wave crashes the shore. I am knocked to my knees. Drenched, I struggle to regain my footing, determined to face the coming storm. The next 10 days will be consumed waiting to learn whether we have a future. Lauren insists all will be well. I want to believe, but I don't want to make promises I can't keep. I share the image of my lone vigil against the storm with our youngest son. Mom, he chides me, you need to rethink that image. You are not alone. Others are on that beach, joining hands, linking arms. What comfort those words bring. I construct visions of rows and rows of friends, family, loved ones, volunteers, medical professionals, and all those who will join me in facing the crashing waves, forming a barrier that surrounds me in love and healing. Another day, another doctor. You have a rare lymphoma. This is something you will learn to live with, not die from. There will be work ahead. It will be hard, but we can do hard. Storm clouds threaten, but hints of blue appear. I am filled with gratitude for the community that will see me through. I am not alone.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we talk to the host and reporter behind a new podcast from Wisconsin Watch and WPR that looks at the power prosecutors have in our criminal justice system. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Prosecutors have a lot of power in the criminal justice system, and with that much power concentrated on one side of a criminal case, a prosecutor's decisions can have a big impact on the accused and on the outcome. A new podcast from Wisconsin Watch and WPR takes a closer look at the role of the prosecutor through the lens of a number of criminal cases here in Wisconsin. It's called Open and Shut. It is out today. Phoebe Petrovic is the host and reporter behind Open and Shut. Phoebe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a legal expert you talked to in the first episode. This is Angela J. Davis from American University. To clarify, not the activist Angela Davis, talking about the power prosecutors have in this clip. Here's a listen.
Police officers can only bring individuals to the courthouse door. It is the prosecutor who decides whether that individual will remain in the system and what they'll be charged with.
Phoebe, tell us more about what makes prosecutors such important players in the system and why it matters.
Yeah, so Angela Jordan Davis is a brilliant legal scholar reporting and researching the power of prosecutors. And she tells us that prosecutors are the most powerful actors or officials in the criminal justice system because they have two main powers: the power to bring charges, which is what you heard in that clip, and the power to broker plea deals. So whereas a police officer can pull you over or arrest you, it's the prosecutor who decides whether or not you are actually going to face criminal charges based off of that arrest. And then through the ability to choose which charges, you know, that carry particular sentences, how many charges, and offer a plea deal, they really have the power to decide in some ways how long you will be entangled in the system. Plea bargaining happens in the vast majority of cases in Wisconsin and across the country. And so that means that the trial that people facing criminal charges, quote unquote, receive often takes place, in fact, in the prosecutor's office. And that's a paraphrase from the Center for Public Integrity, instead of in a courtroom before a jury of your peers.
You look at the issues through the lens of a couple different prosecutors, past and present. One is Vince Biskupic. Can you introduce us to him?
Absolutely. So Vince Biskupic is one of two prosecutors in the Fox Valley that we focused on, using them as a lens through which to view this larger system. Vince Biskupic is a former district attorney from Outagamie County. He came into office in 1994. Prior to that, he had most recently been the deputy district attorney in Winnebago County. And Biskupic was the DA in Outagamie County from 1994 to 2002. Now, that's an elected position. So he was the chief elected prosecutor in the county, bringing cases on behalf of the state. And his career as a prosecutor ended in 2002 when he unsuccessfully ran for attorney general against Peg Lautenschlager.
Can you introduce us to some of the cases that Biskupic was involved in?
Absolutely. So we look at, you know, a half a dozen criminal cases that were considered sort of high profile cases from his career. These include an arson case, several homicide cases from Kokana, a rape case. So it really sort of spans the gamut of high level felony cases. In all of those, he gained convictions. In some of these cases that we look at, those convictions were challenged in appeals courts. And in two cases, they were convictions were either withdrawn or overturned.
You find in some cases accusations of irregularities in what prosecutors do, both Biskupic and Joe Paulus, another one, accusations that they handled things wrong in one way or another. What were some of the common elements that you ran into?
Sure. So a lot of our reporting focused on discovery. And so discovery is one of the most important aspects of any type of litigation. In a criminal case, that means the exchange of information between the prosecutor and the defense. And when you think about a criminal case, the defendant, is facing off against a prosecutor who has the police on their side, has potentially the state crime lab involved. So there's a lot of evidence that the state has and that statutes require the prosecutor to disclose. But one of the sort of structural problems is that the statute, the Wisconsin discovery statute, doesn't specify exactly when the prosecutor has to turn over the information they have to turn over. And they don't necessarily have to do it prior to plea bargaining. And so many of the cases that we look at, sort of spanning the series, have in one way or another allegations of information or important evidence being improperly withheld. And the importance of that is that it, you know, it means that there isn't, that the defendant isn't able to argue their cases properly, or, you know, maybe they took a plea deal when they might have gone to trial to fight their case, their defense attorney isn't able to cross-examine the witness or a witness as effectively as they might have if they had all the information that the prosecutor had at their disposal.
And speaking of witnesses, another common theme in the first couple episodes is another power prosecutors have to get somebody to offer their witness testimony against somebody being charged. They can offer that other person a nicer plea deal if they happen to be accused of a crime. How common is that tactic?
You know, that's common, and that also is perfectly legal and the standard practice. Mm. It's perfectly acceptable for that to happen. One of the problems we saw in our reporting, and that is pretty well documented, is the problem is if that incentive or if that deal isn't disclosed to the defense and to the jury. So often if a witness comes to testify against a co-defendant, let's say at a trial, there are standard questions that a prosecutor asks, you know, have we promised you a deal? Are you doing this of your own volition? Things like that. And sometimes that's very well the case. The problem in the cases that we've uncovered is potentially that not being disclosed.
One thing that struck me is a lot of times people are worried about wrongful convictions, the wrong person being put in prison for a crime. You also look at people who almost certainly did the crime they were accused of. Why is it important to focus on prosecutorial potential misconduct, even in those cases?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something I came up against while reporting this series a lot, from people saying, this person is so guilty. Why does it matter? Why do we care? And the answer that I got from law professors, people who study this for a living, people who are criminal defense attorneys themselves, they say it matters because we have to test the integrity of our system against the hard cases, even the brutal cases. You know, one law professor who told me this had just come back from overviewing military commissions hearings in Guantanamo Bay. And she's like, it's really important that we have due process for everyone in our system, because if we're not doing it in those cases, we're not doing it at all. And some of the cases we had allegations that, a person, admitted to being part of a homicide, but potentially was due, potentially could have benefited from a slightly lower sentence, depending on whether or not all the information was disclosed. So for some people, this can mean the difference between dying in prison or having the chance at parole. And then we also talked to, friends and family members of crime victims or people who testified in criminal trials as witnesses, who said, I'm totally convinced that this person is guilty and I really want that conviction to stick. And so if there was anything in the prosecution of this case that undermines the integrity of that conviction, that's a problem for me, because then I'm not so secure and I don't have closure. And so it's important to do that right.
Thanks to Phoebe Petrovic, creator of the Open and Shut podcast.